Right. Well, hello. Good morning, everyone. I think there's still some seats over here in the front. Yeah, a couple of seats there, one over there, a couple of them over there. Great. So welcome to Africa. It's a bit warm in here. I live in Israel, so for us it's a pretty normal temperature. It's like 30 degrees back home, a bit colder in here. Anyway, my name is Sasha. I work in Israel. I live in Israel at a company called Sela Group. We do training and consulting. We're Microsoft partners, of course, and so I'm very happy to be here today. Last time I was in the area was, I think, more than 10 years ago, so it's really great to come visit again, even if it's just for a couple of days. So we have, I have three talks at Tech Days, all focused on Windows Azure mobile services and notification hubs. And this is the first one in which we'll talk about building iOS and Android applications with Windows Azure mobile services, rebranded Microsoft Azure mobile services now. The other talk I have at the end of the day, which will focus on building C# and .NET applications with mobile services and also using C# on the back end, on the service itself. And then I have another talk tomorrow focused on notification hubs, delivering millions of push notifications to your users in a scalable fashion. Now, let me just ask you this. How many of you are iOS or Android developers currently? Okay. And the rest of you are just interested, I guess, are thinking of getting in the mobile development field. So let me just say this. I'm not going to use the Xamarin tools or PhoneGap or anything of that sort in this talk. We're going to build native mobile apps for iOS and Android. So the iOS app is going to be Objective-C. The Android app is going to be Java. But again, the message is, I hope, going to be clear, even if you're not currently doing development in Java or Objective-C. And of course, all the source code will be available to you after the session on my blog. I'll post it on Twitter and so on. So let's just get started. Who are we? App developers, or hopefully app developers. And what do we hate? We hate servers, we hate backends, we hate databases. I mean, to some extent at least. I started out as a server guy, and I do C++ and C# still. But when building a mobile app, especially when prototyping, especially when getting to your first 100,000 users or so, you really don't care about the backend. You just want a backend that's there, that's available, that's scalable, that will sort of grow with you. And then at some point, you're going to start investing in that backend more seriously. But I mean, for proof of concept applications, for getting started, for the MVP product of yours, you really want the minimum investment in your backend. And so Azure Mobile Services is this backend, well, one of those backends for your mobile applications. It has a free tier, so you can get started with development and even putting your applications in the hands of some of your users, like several hundred users, for totally free. It has cloud scale for when you have more users, for when you need to send millions of push notifications or do authentication or store lots of data. It's Azure, it's a cloud after all. You have storage services, you have database services, you have push notification services, you have authentication services, so it really can scale together with your application. And it has support for all the major mobile platforms, and I'll get back to that in a couple of minutes, but basically iOS and Android are two major mobile platforms today, but there's also support for Windows 8, Windows Phone, and additional frameworks and platforms. And it's all REST-based, so essentially if your platform can talk HTTP, well, you can use Windows Azure Mobile Services for your application for all of its different features. So let's take a look at the platforms and features. I'm going to only cover those in a couple of sentences each, and then hopefully once we start building our app, it's going to be more evident exactly what it means. So on the platform side, well, the first two platforms actually that Azure Mobile Services supported when it was released about a year and a half ago in preview form were iOS and Windows Store, Windows 8 applications. So there was first-class support right from the onset for non-Microsoft platforms. And so here we are at a Microsoft conference with a bunch of Microsoft branding, with a Microsoft logo over there in the corner, talking about building iOS and Android applications. And this really is a great thing that started within Microsoft with Windows Azure, but hopefully you can see it now getting through other areas of Microsoft as well. And so we have support for iOS, Android, Windows Phone, Windows 8. These are the major mobile platforms, so to speak. There's also support for HTML and JavaScript applications, which mean you can build a website and, you know, serve your website from some hosting provider, but have your backend for that website still supported by Windows Azure Mobile Services. You could have a single page application in your browser that's served and supported by mobile services. There's support for PhoneGap, so you can explicitly build mobile applications with PhoneGap in JavaScript and HTML and use mobile services behind them. And finally, there's also some new support for Xamarin. Xamarin is a framework platform that helps you build C# applications for iOS and Android. So you can use that as well with mobile services. There's native built-in client libraries for all of those platforms. Now, on the server side, what do you actually get from this backend? So obviously, one thing you're going to do with the backend is store data in it. So Windows Azure Mobile Services gives you a backend with a database. And actually, as of just a couple of weeks ago, there is now support for more than just one backend. You don't have to use SQL Server, which used to be the mobile services backend store for a year and a half or so. You can now use Mongo. You can now use Azure Table Storage. You can now use pluggable data stores. So you can build one of your own and store your data whenever you want. But again, SQL database is still going to be what we use in this talk because it's still the default and it's still the easiest one to use. It's a bit more expensive than using Mongo or Table Storage, so you can definitely scale to those backends if you need to. And you have support for queries. So your mobile app doesn't only store data and retrieve data by ID. You can run complex queries. In iOS, it's using predicates. In Android, they've developed in the client library their own framework for building complex queries. And it's all supported by OData. So if you're, again, if your client can speak HTTP, it can issue OData queries, which will be executed on the backend, and you only get back the data that you actually need, and not, you know, the whole table, and filter it on the client side. We have support for push in mobile services, so you can send push notifications to your users. It used to be the case that you have to manage the push registrations manually, and that's what we're going to do in this talk, but notification hubs integrate with mobile services and take away the pain of managing push notification channels in your backend. And that's something I'm going to only cover briefly here, but I have a whole talk on notification hubs tomorrow. There's support for authentication. So mobile services can help you authenticate your users through Twitter, Facebook, Google, or Microsoft accounts. And there's also support for Windows Azure Active Directory, which means you can plug in your own usernames and passwords if you need to. But if your users prefer to use one of those social identities that they already have, you don't have to force them to, you know, create a new username, choose a password, store the password, hash the password, whatever it is. You can use one of the existing OAuth providers for that. And again, the backend helps you with authenticating the user, making sure only authenticated users can perform certain requests, giving you the information about the currently authenticated user for every request, and so on. There's support for customization in that backend, and that's called server-side scripts in the JavaScript version, which we're going to be using today. In the .NET backend, which we're not going to look at, it's just plain C# code. In the JavaScript version, it's just a bunch of JavaScript scripts running on top of Node. And again, I'm going to get back to that later. There's support for custom APIs, so you can expose arbitrary HTTP endpoints from your mobile service. You don't have to only work with data, like insert something, update something, retrieve something. You can have custom APIs which execute on your backend and do some kind of mashup of whatever data you have or work with some other web service on your behalf. We have support for offline sync, which is a super cool new feature which was just announced at Build 2 weeks ago. This is currently only supported for Windows Store applications, and so we're not going to look at it here. I do have another talk on it later today. I'm going to stop with this advertising of my other talks now. And so offline sync basically means that you can work with your data even if you're not actually connected to your mobile service. So you can perform operations offline and then sync, push the data to your server, pull the updates from your server when necessary. And again, currently we only have offline sync for Windows Store applications, but, well, hopefully there is also support coming for iOS and Android. The offline sync support on Windows Store apps uses SQLite, which is the same client-side database we have already on iOS and Android, so there's a good chance the APIs and the workflow is going to be pretty similar. We have support for mass push, which I've already mentioned. If you don't have to, if you have to deliver millions of push notifications to your users, sending them one by one is going to take, I don't know, weeks, months, years probably. And so there's support in mobile services for sending a single push notifications to millions of users using tag expressions, complex expressions that specify exactly which users you want to target. And then finally, there's source control integration. So once you start customizing your backend, you definitely will want to use source control for rollbacks, for branching, for merges, and so on. And so mobile services supports Git integration, so you can make your changes locally, push them to the mobile service, and the cloud version updates according to what you pushed to source control. So that's like a brief overview of the features. Let's take a look at an architecture diagram that I came up with. So on the left, we have a bunch of different client devices, iPhones, iPads, Android devices, Windows devices, tablets, websites, and so on. In Microsoft Azure, we have two major components. One is the database. SQL database is the default SQL server, but again, it can be replaced with Mongo. It can be replaced with table storage, which is a cheaper version, another NoSQL database provided by Windows Azure. And we have the backend itself, which for this talk, we're going to be using the Node.js backend, which uses Express. Express is a popular MVC framework for Node applications, which basically means your backend uses JavaScript. And you can use JavaScript to customize exactly how your backend works using server scripts and custom APIs. And then we have also support for push and authentication. And these aren't necessarily hosted by Microsoft. So for example, you have support for Facebook authentication. So the Microsoft Cloud will talk to Facebook, and so you get authentication built in. You also have support for push. So for example, GCM, the Google Cloud Messaging Service, which gives you push on Android devices, again, the Microsoft service will talk to GCM and send push notifications to your clients. So you don't have to integrate with all of these various services directly. You have support for them in your backend hosted by Microsoft. So before we get started with code and stuff, I just want to show you the first experience you'll have when creating a mobile service in the Windows Azure portal. So let me just go back here. This is the Windows Azure portal, and there's a mobile services section over here. Now, I have a few of them existing already. We're going to be using the Rent-a-Home mobile service, which I've already created. But before we get to that, I just want to show you the experience you'd have when creating your first mobile service from scratch. And so I'm just going to go to this big new button down here. And then I have mobile service, create. We're going to have to pick a name for that service. So for now, I'm just going to use one of the built-in samples. To-do list is already taken. To-do list tech days is available. I'm going to say let's use an existing SQL database because I already have one. And let's pick a region. I'm going to go with North Europe. And I can pick my backend language, which, again, I have JavaScript and we have .NET in preview, which we won't see today. Once we have that set up, I click Next, and then it asks me for my database settings, and it tells me, well, I'm sorry, you only have a database in the East US region, which is not in the same region as your mobile service. So I'm going to go back, and I'm actually going to tell it, let's create a new SQL database. Let's call it To-Do List Tech Days DB. Let's put it on a new SQL database server with the login name To-Do List, password, something. Oh, well, must meet some requirements. Okay. There we go. North Europe. I don't have any advanced database settings to configure, so I'm just going to click the V. And now it's going ahead and creating that mobile service. It will take a bit longer than usual because it also has to provision a SQL Server database, which, as you know, can take a while if you've ever created a SQL database of your own. And then we're going to have that mobile service provisioned. To save some time, I'm just going to open one of the existing ones that I already have, like this Rent-a-Home mobile service, which we will be working with later. And so what you see now is a quick start. And this is basically what you'll see for the first time you create your mobile service, so you can skip that the next time. And then you can choose a platform you want to target. So we have Windows Store, Windows Phone, iOS, Android, JavaScript, Xamarin, PhoneGap. It doesn't even fit on the screen. There's so many platforms it supports. And if I pick something, like maybe iOS, then right down here, I have this Get Started section, which says create a new iOS app or connect to an existing iOS app. If you just take a look at the connect part, because that's probably what you'll do for your real iOS applications, then basically what you have to do is download the SDK, there's a link over here, unzip it, then go to your project in Xcode and add a reference to that framework which you've just downloaded, add an import, add a property, write a bunch of code, store data, so there's detailed instructions over here. But instead, we're going to go with create a new iOS app, and hopefully we already have that Tech Days service provisioned. So once I go here, and again I pick iOS, and click create a new iOS app, then what it says is simpler. Get the tools, you need Xcode. Create a table, so you'll have something to store your data in, and I can just click this button, and it's going to create a table for me. Dum-da-dum-da-dum. Creating. Okay, it's going to come back very shortly. And then finally, download your personalized starter project, extract it, and open it in Xcode. Sounds good. So let's download that. I'm going to put it in a special folder I already have for this. I'm going to extract it. And so here's what I get. I get an Xcode project, which I can now open, which is already pre-configured with all the access information I need to access that specific mobile service I've just created, not some arbitrary template. It's a specific project for my specific mobile service. So if I open that in Xcode and just you know, run this thing, it's opening a new iOS simulator. And this is the app we get. There shouldn't be anything in it right now, but it's already set up to display and add to-do items. Let me enter some text. Build a real app. And it's there. Now, obviously, this could all be a mock-up. I mean, it doesn't necessarily store anything anywhere. It might all be happening offline. Well, let's go back to the portal. And so if I go to the data tab, there is a table here called to-do item. And if I click that table, then we can see that build a real app is really there. So what the tools give you is a personalized starter project which gives you access to your own table in Windows Azure. There's a similar experience for Android, so let me walk you through this quickly. If we go back to the quick start, and I pick Android as my platform, I'm going to say create a new Android apps. Well, create a table isn't necessary anymore. We already have a table. And so all that's left to do is download our personalized starter project and extract it. So I'm going to download it, save it, extract it. There it is, to-do list tech days number 2. And all I need to do now, basically, is go to Eclipse. I already got the service we're going to be using later, but I'm going to import existing projects into Workspace. I'm going to pick that folder, Workspace 13, To-Do List Tech Days number 2. Some projects cannot be imported because they already exist in the Workspace. Well, let's not copy. That's interesting. Let's go with a new instance of Eclipse. Let's switch workspace. Dum-da-dum. Okay, Eclipse is starting up. Welcome to Eclipse. And so I'm going to do this import again. Existing projects into workspace. This is my folder. This is my project. Okay, this is better. I'm going to finish the import. We have the Eclipse project over there. Refresh. There we are. So source is here. We have a reference to mobile services. This is the equivalent to the iOS framework which we had. And so now, if I just run this app, it's an Android application. on my Android emulator, which I have open right here. It's Eclipse is not connected to it. Let's do a reset over here. The iOS was easier. Okay, there we are. It recognizes the emulator now. Let's launch again. And so it does say down there, launching to-do list tech days. You definitely can't see this, but it looks successful. And so here is the Android version of our mobile service. And it's actually supposed to display something already. There's this spinning thing over there, and there it is, build a real app. Let's add something else, build an Android app as well. Click Add. Goes to the back end. Slowly but surely, it's stored over there. Now if we open the iOS app again and just do a quick refresh, then sure enough, it shows there as well. So again, I know this isn't your app. I know this is not what you're going to be building, but these templates are really helpful for getting started. I mean, you can just check the whole flow. You can definitely demo this to your boss and hopefully convince them that there's something worth trying over here. So now I'm going to, again, I haven't shown you a single line of code, so I'm going to quickly walk through a couple of slides with code examples, and then we're going to go back and enhance that mobile service and the app a little bit, adding some features as we go. So first, let's take a look at data queries. Suppose you want to retrieve to-do items from that table you have in mobile services, and you have to you want to specify some query criteria, like maybe you only want to-do items that haven't been completed yet, or maybe you only want to-do items created in the last week, or maybe you only want to-do items that were created by a particular user. So you can specify a query from your iOS application using, hopefully, a familiar pattern using the NSPredicate class. NSPredicate is, I wish I could say it's similar to link in C#, but it's a bit more primitive. But basically, you can specify expressions which will be translated to a query that's going to run on the server. So in this case here, predicate with format rented equals equals no. Well, this is not for to-do items. This is for apartments, for the app we're going to be building later on. But this is the predicate of the query, the specific items I want to retrieve. And then we just do read with predicate and get back, through a completion block, an array of items. Now, the reason I'm showing you this is that you see and learn that the iOS SDK is untyped. You get back objects and dictionaries. Specifically, each of those items you get back from the table is an NS dictionary instance. And then you can just go ahead and grab the specific properties from that. You have a column in your database called address. You grab it from the dictionary by just, you know, subscripting the dictionary. You have a property in your table called bedrooms. You grab that from the dictionary by subscripting the dictionary. So you don't have to use strong types if you don't want to. And again, on iOS, that sort of makes sense. That aligns with many other APIs for accessing web services. But on Android, this actually makes less sense. On Android, again, in Java, people are used to strong types. And so the Android SDK is indeed a bit different. In the Android SDK, you first have to go and create a class that describes the item you have, the items you're going to have in your table. In this case, it's a class called apartment. And so once you have that class, you can issue queries like this. And again, this is the link equivalent that we have for Android queries. So I can say where field rented equals false, and that just sort of constructs fluently a query that you're going to run on the back end. And then I can say execute and provide again a callback, which gets a list of apartments. So this is strongly typed. The serialization and deserialization happened here on your behalf. It's all, by the way, based on JSON, so it's JSON objects that are getting passed through. And then finally, we have this items list, which we can simply iterate because it's just strongly typed apartment objects with their properties, methods, and so on. So this is for data queries. Let's take a look at the sample app we have just to demonstrate this point. So here's the iOS version, and it's got here a to-do service class right over here with a couple of methods like add item, complete item, and there is also in the view controller code that will retrieve items from that table. Oh, sorry, that's refresh data on success. Where's that? Refresh data on success, there it is. So let's take a look at refresh data on success. Here's refresh data on success in the iOS version. Create a predicate that finds items where complete is false. Suppose we want to go the other way around. Maybe we only want to find items where complete is yes. And then read with predicate completion, get the items, call the completion block. All looks good. If I launch this now, then we're not getting anything because we changed the predicate. If on Android, I now go ahead and check the checkbox over here, then this goes ahead and updates the backend saying, well, this is a completed to-do item. And so on Android, it doesn't show up anymore. But on iOS, if I refresh, then it does show up because we changed that predicate. Let's do the same thing in on Android, just to show you again the generated code. So here's the to-do item activity. And somewhere over here should be the query. It's probably in the adapter. No, it's not in the adapter. It's actually somewhere over here. Client get table, and then we should have refresh apartments or something similar. There it is, refresh items from table. So again, it says where field complete equals false and so on. So let's just change this again to true and rerun the app. So now, instead of build an Android app, which was not marked as complete yet, we should see the one that we did mark as complete, which is to build a real app. Let's see if it does work. A bit slower on Android. Refreshing. Refreshing. Still refreshing. And that's a wired connection, which is quite fast. Well, there it is, build a real app. So this is how the predicates work. To show you another example of working with data, let's take a look at the insert operation where we add new to-do items to the table. So here's what it looks like on Android. Here's the add item method. I'm definitely going to zoom in on this thing. So here's the add item method. It basically goes ahead and creates a new model object. This is a strongly typed class called to-do item. And then it goes ahead and sets it text and complete parameters. And finally, it calls an insert method with that item and with a callback, which will execute once that operation completes. And the callback goes ahead and adds it to the adapter, so it's displayed by the UI. On iOS, there's a pretty similar API. Over here, add item completion. So basically what it does, it takes in a dictionary. So again, no strongly typed objects, just a plain NS dictionary. And it says table insert item with a completion block, which is again invoked once the operation completes. And it goes ahead and calls a completion block, which updates the table view on iOS. So we have these basic, you know, data queries, inserts, updates, deletes, the CRUD operations. They're really easy to implement. And so we now have a table in SQL Azure somewhere in the cloud, and we access that table from our clients using a strongly typed nice SDK without building the intermediary service ourselves. But of course, there's room for customization here. So let's take a look at one option for customization which we might have. Suppose that we have these to-do items and so on, and we want to assign them to users. So obviously, a user should only be able to modify to-do items which that user created. Maybe even we want to show to the user only to-do items which that user created. So currently, our implementation doesn't support that. It just goes ahead and reads everything from the table. And I also don't want to hard code that on the client. I mean, I don't trust the client to only retrieve the items that this client created. I need to do this on the server, right? I have to force the server to make this authorization. So we can write scripts in JavaScript that will execute on each of the operations you issue against your tables. So whenever you read from a table, insert something to a table, update a table, delete something from a table, these scripts will get invoked. It's sort of like triggers, essentially, which can run before and after the actual table operation is performed. And of course, you can abort the operation and just return some status code. For example, in this case, this script over here is just a plain JavaScript function called delete, which takes three parameters: item, user, and request. Item is the actual item that you're performing the operation on. This is the object that you're updating, deleting, inserting, and so on. User provides you data about the user's identity. And specifically, it has a property called user ID, which is an internal ID that mobile services will generate for you when the user is authenticated. And finally, there's a request object, which is which represents the HTTP request. And you can respond to the request, you can reject the request, and so on. In this case, we check, well, is the user ID on the item equal to the user ID of the user performing the operation? If they are equal, then wonderful, and we just execute the request, and this goes ahead and performs the default operations, specifically deleting from the table. Otherwise, we respond to the request with a 403, which is HTTP forbidden, and we also provide an explanation: you may only delete your own items. You cannot delete other items. So where do you put these scripts? Well, one way to add these scripts to your service is using the Azure portal. And this, well, it works well for demos, but obviously it doesn't scale. At some point, you're going to make these edits offline and push them to source control or something similar. But for now, let's just use the portal for this. So I go to the data tab, and I choose my table. And then I have a script section over here. And so in the script section, I can customize the scripts for each of the major operations: insert, update, delete, and read. For example, we could, again, go ahead and say, well, when you try to delete an to-do item, then, again, we get the ID of the item that's going to be deleted, the user and the request, and we customize that. Instead, because the app doesn't actually issue deletes, instead I'm going to change the update method so that... it says something like this: if item.complete, then request respond 500. Otherwise, request execute. And again, this is just to show you that the script is actually working. So I type this whole thing in my browser, which again, only works well for demos. And then I go ahead and click save. And it's saving the script. Essentially, it's sort of doing a little deployment of your service over there in the background. Let's take a look at our table right now. So in our table, we have one item which isn't marked as complete yet. So I'm going to change my app so that it shows me the incomplete items. And then I'm going to try to change this complete to true. And hopefully, we'll see the operation fail. So going back to the Xcode version, for example, let me change the predicate again so it shows me incomplete items. Then I'm going to click run. It's going to retrieve the one incomplete item that we still have. Coming up, there it is. And now I'm going to try and mark it as complete. So I did that, and it disappeared from the UI. But in the background, there's actually some log output, which I'm going to focus on right here. It says, well, sorry, there was an error. The server returned an error. I have access to the HTTP response if I want to. But essentially, the operation was not really performed. If I refresh the table, you'll notice that build an Android app is still marked as incomplete. So the script we just wrote in the portal actually affects the operation we perform against that mobile service. Does that make sense so far? Well, so we have scripts. And the last thing I want to show you in the slides is authentication. So suppose you want to log in with Facebook or Twitter or a Google account or Microsoft account. Well, obviously, there's something you have to do first to establish your app with these providers. You have to... For example, for Facebook, you have to create a Facebook app. If you're working with Twitter, you have to register with Twitter, again, create a Twitter app. This doesn't actually require you to work with their APIs. You don't have to access Facebook. You don't have to access Twitter. You just have to register to say this app intends to authenticate users through your service. Once you've done that, you can use very simple APIs on the client to authenticate users, and the user identity will flow through into your mobile service. So here's what it looks like on iOS. You have a simple method called login with provider. and it just takes a string, which could be Facebook, Microsoft, Google, or Twitter. Also takes a controller, animated, and a completion block. And the completion block returns an object of type MSUser, which you can use on the client to get the new user's identity. Maybe you want your app to then go to Facebook and get the user's friends or something. But that's up to you. The authentication flow is provided by the mobile service. On Android, it's pretty similar. You have a login method, which takes an enumeration, mobile service authentication provider dot Facebook, Twitter, Microsoft, Google, and a callback, which gives you the mobile service user if that operation completes successfully. And again, you can use that to, if you want to integrate with Facebook or Twitter or anything else. So let's try to do a quick demo of just that. I'm going to go to dev.twitter.com, which is Twitter developers, and then I'm going to sign in. I'm going to sign in with a fake user I have just for these presentations, John McUser. Log in. There we are. And then I'm going to go over here to my applications. I'm signed in. Okay, John McUser. Don't remember me. There we go. And I'm going to create a new Twitter app. Let's call this To-Do List Tech Days. It really doesn't matter what you call it. It's just going to be displayed to the user. So probably should match what your app is. A description, well, To-Do List Tech Days demo app using mobile services. A website. I don't remember the actual website, so let's go with google.com for now. And the callback URL. And this is important. Again, I'm not sure that as mobile developers we really should care about OAuth flows, but the OAuth flow, when you authenticate with an OAuth provider, dictates that when the user returns from Twitter or Facebook or whatever service they use to log in, then your web service is going to be called back with the token of that user, establishing the fact that the authentication was successful. And so if you're doing your own OAuth integration, you're going to have to develop a web service which takes this callback and does something with the token. In our case, we're just simply going to use mobile services. So all this really needs to take is our mobile service URL, which is the mobile service name, which is to-do list tech days dot azuremobile.net. Okay, developer rules of the road. We agree. And so I'm going to go and create my Twitter application. There we are. It's been created. Under settings, I will then check one checkbox, allow this application to be used to sign in with Twitter, which is the whole purpose of what we're doing. So I'm just going to say yes, please. Update settings. And then I'm going to go to API keys. And over here, I have the API keys, which I now need to tell my mobile service about. These API keys are the way of establishing that only your application can sign in with Twitter using that specific application name. So I'm going to need the API key and the API secret. I can't copy them both at the same time, so let's start with the API key. Going back to my mobile service, under the Identity tab, I have Microsoft settings, Facebook settings, Twitter settings. So, consumer key is this. Consumer secret is this. Just pasting them in. And then I hit save. It goes ahead and saves the settings. And now our client app can actually authenticate with Twitter. So, first thing I'm going to do, and this time let's do it with the iOS. First thing I'm going to do is somewhere around my view controller, like maybe in view did load, somewhere over here. Before I do anything, I'm going to try and authenticate with Twitter. So I'm going to say, I actually need the client. Login with provider, controller, animated, completion. So the provider is Twitter. The controller is going to be safe. Animated yes, and let's get a completion block back. So in this completion block, I will get MS user and NS error. Let's log them both. User error. Right? So I've just added that. Let's run the app. This is the login view controller they were talking about. Basically just pops up this screen, which hosts a web view that's going to load the Twitter login screen for you. Authorized to Duelist Tech Days to use your account? Okay, well, let's authorize. So John McUser. You see why I use a fake user for this? Sign in. I did click sign in, right? I think I clicked sign in. Let's click sign in again. I'm really trying. Okay, let's try canceling this once. What it printed out here is user null and error, the login operation was canceled, which is fine. I wish it didn't cancel. Let's try again. John McUser. Sign in, there we are. Okay, so we were redirected back to the application, and if I look at the output again, then here it is. We now have a valid MS user, and there was no error. So the user is signed in now. How can we take advantage of that? Well, one thing we could do is now, when the user inserts a new to-do item, we can actually store the owner of that to-do item. So then we can perform additional authorization for updates, for queries, and so on. So I'm going to go back to my script. On the data tab, I have this to-do item area with my scripts, and we have this insert script. And so the only thing I'm going to do really is the following. If user user ID, then item.user ID equals user user ID. Now, you might ask, the item here is a to-do item. Doesn't have a user ID property, doesn't have a user ID column. Where here, we're going to be taking advantage of a really nice feature of the JavaScript backend, which is called dynamic schema. Basically, whenever you add additional properties on the object that you're going to be inserting, the table is also updated with additional columns. So it's like dynamic SQL Server. This is something you're going to want to disable for production. You don't want new columns popping up in your database, but for development, it's really useful. You just basically set new properties, and they show up in the table as if, you know, they were always there. So let me just make this change and save. Saving the script, slowly but surely. So if we look at the table now, you'll notice that there is no such column yet. We only have ID, text, complete, created at, updated at, version, which were generated by the service. There is yet no user ID column here. Once we insert something through the iOS app, this is my to-do item, and click add, goes ahead and inserts it. If I refresh here, and again, there we are. So all of a sudden, we do have a user ID column, which is set to null for the previous rows we had, but it's set to that user's ID once we have a user ID. And as you can see here, it says what the authentication provider was, and then there is some provider-specific identifier. This isn't the username, but you can use this to retrieve the user's name, and I'm going to show you how. So for now, we have also authentication built in, and we can customize our scripts now to retrieve only that user's to-do items, to perform authorization so that only that user can delete their to-do items, and so on. It's not built in, but it's now pretty simple to implement. Okay, so I think there's just one thing I haven't shown you, which is push. And so I'm going to do this through a demo. This time it's not going to be the to-do list application. It's going to be a slightly different application, which I'll start by showing you on the client devices. So this application is called Rent a Home. And it's sort of an app for sharing apartments for rent with the various users we have. So it's now refreshing the list. It's going back to the mobile service and getting the list of apartments I currently have. Right, so we have a bunch. Let's go ahead and log in. And as you can see, this is customized for the Rent-a-Home application. I'm going to log in as John McCuser again. We're back in the app. And now I'm going to add a new apartment. 5 bedrooms. Save. And it shows up. Now, here's an interesting thing, which I'll have to explain very shortly. If I click Show Map now, and move away from the United States to Europe, well, right over here we have a pin which says World Forum and so on. So in some magical fashion, the app now knows where that apartment is. I only provided an address. Okay, let's see if it also works on Android. Oh, by the way, I'm getting ahead of myself, but you can see a push notification was delivered to the Android emulator saying a new 5-bedroom apartment was added. But if I open the app now, and this is the Rent-a-Home app, and refresh, here's our apartment. And in the Android app, it also has user information. It says this apartment was added by John McCuser. So this is another interesting thing. How does the app know the username and not just that Twitter ID? And finally, here as well, if I click Map, it's going to show me a map all clustered around Europe. But this is ours, right? So this is the one we've just added. So there's two interesting things here. First, there's getting the user's information. Second, there's the coordinate translation. Address to coordinate translation. And third, there was a push notification that was actually delivered to the Android application once I've added an apartment in the iOS application. So I'm going to show you all of these together in one demo. I also want to leave some time for questions. So let's start with the whole coordinate translation thing. On all platforms, iOS, Android, Windows Phone, Windows 8, you have APIs for translating addresses to coordinates and coordinates back to addresses. It's not really hard to use them. But I don't really want the clients to do this at all. I'd rather do it on my backend, because if an iOS user provides an address and the iOS service happens to translate it to specific coordinates which won't be the same on Android, it really doesn't work well, my app doesn't look well, and I also have to implement the same logic for translating addresses to coordinates on all platforms I support. So it makes more sense for the service to do this. So on my backend, if we go to the Rent-a-Home mobile service, I have an apartments table for storing apartment information. And as you can see here, it has geographic coordinate columns, which are somehow populated by the backend. It also stores the address itself, which the user provided. So if we look at the scripts here, and specifically the script for the insert operation, this is where I'm translating the coordinate, the address to coordinates. Rather than viewing this in the portal, I just have it open over here. This is the script. I'm not going to really show you source control integration, but there's a great story around this. I can make changes offline and then sync that to my Git repository, which is hosted by mobile services. So I'm really showing you the files I have locally in my local Git repository. So this is the insert script for apartments. And the interesting section is over here, continue processing. So first I go ahead and the URL escape the user provided address. And then I just talk to the Google API, which is one of the options for geocoding. So no magic there. I'm just issuing an HTTP GET request. And I'm saying maps, Google APIs, map, API, geocode, JSON, address, and I'm piping in the address I already have, and then in the response I have location coordinates, latitude and longitude, which I can then add to my newly inserted item. Again, these two lines over here, item latitude, item longitude, these are essentially new properties. The user didn't pass them in. I'm setting them based on the information I get from the Google Geocoding service. In fact, I could even make sure that the user cannot pass them in. I could start by erasing these columns so that if the geocoding process fails, I still will not insert whatever the user provided. So again, I have these scripts which give me full control over what's happening in my backend. And once I have that, on the client side, I only need to read this information so that I can display it on a map. So whenever I query the server, I just get these latitude and longitude columns like any other columns once I've changed them on the server. So I'm not going to show you that code. The other thing, as I've mentioned, is getting the user's name based on the ID. So the code for that is also in the insert script. I want to ask Twitter for the user's name, maybe their email, some additional information, based only on that ID which I have. So here's how it works. That user object you get passed in has a handy method called getIdentities. And then this thing will contain the Twitter, Facebook, Google, Microsoft, Windows, Azure, Active Directory identity of the signed in user. So if I have a Twitter identity here, then I use a little shared script to get that user's name. So there's a bunch of code here, but it all boils down to getting that user's name from Twitter and setting yet another property on my apartment, which I'm going to insert now, and this time it's called username. So I'm just, again, getting this information from Twitter and then putting it in the item I'm going to insert. Now the script which actually talks to Twitter is this thing over here, twitter-get-user.js, and it's a bit longish. There's a bunch of code here because, well, there's better ways to do this now. There are better modules for talking to Twitter from JavaScript than there were when I wrote this demo initially. But basically, you have to, as of July last year, when you talk to Twitter, you have to sign your requests. And that's a bit bulky, so you need a bunch of code that will generate the request, sign it, pass it to Twitter, get a response back, and so on. So there's a bunch of code here, really, which isn't very interesting. It's infrastructure. But this talks to Twitter and gets back information for a specific user using this endpoint. api.twitter.com, users, show JSON, user ID. And I pass in the ID, get back a user object information, which has, among other things, that user's name. So this is the other part I want to show you. The one thing we have remaining, which is obviously very interesting and cool, is the push support. So again, let me try and demo it live, intentionally this time. I'm going to add an apartment. Well, let's go with Tel Aviv. 3 bedrooms. Save. So it gets saved here, and immediately you can see in the emulator there is a notification that pops up. Let me pull that down. New 3-bedroom apartment added. Doesn't fit the whole text, but it says at Tel Aviv, Israel, and so on. So there is a push notification that's being delivered to the Android device. I wish I could show you the same thing with iOS, but the simulator does not support push notifications. You cannot send push notifications to the iOS simulator. I do have an iPhone in my pocket, but it would be a bit weird for you to see my screen, right? So just trust me that on a real iOS device, push notifications in this particular demo will also work. So let's take a look at the infrastructure required to support push. So again, you have a bunch of different push providers. You have the Apple push notification service. You have Google Cloud Messaging. That's just for iOS and Android. You also have the Windows push notification service and the Microsoft push notification service for Windows 8 and Windows Phone, respectively. They are unifying the two, but for now we still have two platforms for push for Windows devices. So you have to, again, do some infrastructure work to register your application with these different push providers. For Google Cloud Messaging, it's pretty easy, free, doesn't require any special work. For Apple, to send push notifications even to your own devices, your own development devices, you have to generate a certificate, upload that, to Apple, get it signed by Apple, and then upload it to Windows Azure so it can send push notifications to iOS devices. This isn't really a problem with mobile services. It's more of an Apple thing. I mean, they make it hard to send push notifications even to development devices. But fortunately, I've done all this infrastructure work already. And so if we go to the portal again and switch to the push tab, you'll notice there's a bunch of information here. I've got my Windows push information. I've got my Apple push information, for which I had to upload the certificate. And I also have my Google Cloud messaging settings, which is an API key, and that's it. So once I have all of that set up, in my scripts, I can use a really nice module, which is provided by Azure Mobile Services, so you don't have to integrate with the different providers yourself. And this module is simply called push. And here's how it works. This is still the apartment insert script we're looking at. And so in this script, somewhere around here, I have a function called send notifications. And just for a second, ignore all this business with channels, which I will explain in a second, but take a look at the code that actually sends the notifications. For example, to send a notification to an iOS device, I say push.apns, Apple Push Notification Service, .send. And that takes a couple of parameters which are specific to iOS. For example, the message that pops up, the badge, the number that shows up on the application's icon, and some additional payload that the app can read when it receives that push. If the channel is Android, then I have a different API, push.gcm.send, which takes different parameters again. So this is part of the pain of dealing with multiple platforms. Each platform has its own idea of what a push notification should look like. For example, on iOS, you basically only have control over the message that pops up and that badge, the number that shows up on your icon. On Android, there's no built-in support for displaying anything really, but on the other hand, you can pass in arbitrary payload, and your application can process that using a service and display a notification, launch the application, put a huge view on the screen. So again, the platforms are really different in terms of how they expect notifications to be delivered, which means that inevitably you have to keep track of which user uses which platform. If you have to send a push notification to an iPhone user, you have to use one API. If you want to send a push notification to an Android user, you have to use a different API. And so this is the channels business that I was talking about here. You have to keep track of the various devices and the kind of device that it is so you can send pushes. So if you look at my tables again, I have a table called channels in addition to the one called apartment. And if we look at the channels table, I only have three columns in it: an ID, which is mandatory, a URI, and a type. So the type is just the platform type. I've got iOS, Windows 8, Windows Phone, Android. This is just something I specified. And the URI over here, which isn't always a URI, and actually for Android and iOS, it's not really a URI, it's just sort of a token. This is what helps me send the push notification to that specific device. So I have a bunch of registrations, if you will, subscriptions, if you will, of all the devices that want to receive from me push notifications. And this table is something I have to manage. I mean, if you're using that approach of sending individual pushes, I have to manage this table. And so my devices, when they register for push notifications, have to insert themselves into that table. I'm just going to show you an example of this on Android. This is the to-do app. Well, let me show you this on iOS because I already have it open in Xcode. On iOS, when you register for push notifications, you have this short handy method called application did register for remote notifications with device token. This method is invoked when your push notification registration was successful. And this gives you that device token I was talking about. And so essentially what this code does is delegate to that apartment service class with that device token. And what the apartment service does in the register device token method, right over here, So what it does is basically go to a table called channels and insert a channel with that token as a URI and iOS as the type. So the clients are responsible of inserting themselves into that table. And your backend is responsible for managing this table, for getting information from it and sending push notifications. So all the various clients have to do something to put themselves in that table. And then on the backend, in this script which we have seen, you can now understand why we have all these various channel types. So if channel type is Windows 8, we do this. If channel type is Windows Phone, we do something else. If channel type is iOS, something different. If channel type is Android, yet another thing. And so for each push platform, you'll need this code. There's two problems with this, right? I mean, one problem is that you have to manage all this information. You need this channels table. You need to insert stuff into it. These channels, they expire after a period of inactivity. So you have to also remove registrations from the table once the subscriptions actually expired. You have to write code that goes through the table and sends different pushes for each platform. So that's a bunch of just, you know, work you have to do on the back end. It's not any harder than if you had to implement this outside of mobile services. It's the same work, essentially. You do have some support from mobile services for delivering the actual push, but you have to manage the registration, and this sucks. The other thing that sort of sucks is that I'm sending the notifications one by one. And if that table has 100 entries, that's fine. It's going to complete in maybe a couple of seconds. If that table has 100 million entries, then the loop I have, which goes and sends a single push notification at a time, even if I do this asynchronously, and this code is asynchronous, like all Node.js code, it's asynchronous, it's still going to take weeks, if not years. And so when the last user gets that push notification, it's going to be totally irrelevant, and probably the device actually will not exist anymore. So it's really hard to scale push to large numbers of users. And again, if this is something that is specifically interesting for you, how to deliver a single push to millions of users, or how to deliver millions of different pushes to millions of different users, then Windows Azure does have a solution for that, which can integrate with mobile services, and it's called Notification Hubs. And even though I again have a full talk on Notification Hubs tomorrow, I do want to show you briefly what this support will look like. So for managing pushes, I have this channels table, and that's what I use to send a notification to my users when a new apartment is added. Whenever a new apartment is added, I notify all my clients, here's a new apartment, check it out. But I also have a different kind of push support for sending ads. I'm trying to monetize my application, so I have a service that I can offer to third parties, so they can send ads through push notifications to my clients. This is actually not allowed by iOS store guidelines, so obviously this is all just a demo. On Android, I believe it is allowed, but again, this isn't a real scenario where you want to send ads to your users through push notifications, hopefully. So let me just show you this briefly. I have a local, simple HTML application running over here. Well, it's not really running yet. Running now. Which we should call this the advertisement delivery portal, right? This is what I offer third parties. I give them a simple text box where they can type their ad, and it gets sent to all the different users of my app at once. And the list of registrations, the actual devices that will receive that ad, is also listed here. This is retrieved from Windows Azure from the Notification Hub. And so, for example, you can see this line over here is a Google device, an Android device that's registered. This line over here is an iOS device, and these two over here are Windows Phone devices. So if I switch to the emulator for a second, let me just clear the notification which I already have, and I type in an ad. Come to Tech Days. And I click Send, and it sends an ad to all of these various users, and indeed you can see on the emulator that the advertisement has popped up. And so here, for sending these notifications, I'm using a different infrastructure than what I showed you previously. This is using notification hubs to deliver the ads, the pushes, and also to manage the registrations. Instead of relying on my channels table for this, I'm using a different Azure service. And here's basically what it looks like. So on the one end, we have an Azure API create notification hub service, which I can use in my backend. This integrates with Azure notification hubs. And then this hub object can manage for me device registrations. Instead of me creating a channels table and storing device registrations in the channels table, I can have this hub thing manage the channels for me. And so the hub has a bunch of APIs, like, for example, over here, I can do hub GCM create registration, hub APNS create registration, hub WNS create registration. These are APIs for the different platforms to register with the notification hub. So again, instead of storing the data in my own tables, I delegate to another Azure service which stores the registrations for me. And what I also get is that if a device becomes unavailable, if a channel expires or the device is lost or whatever, I don't have to manage this myself. The hub will remove these registrations automatically. And then to send a push notification, instead of going and enumerating a channels table and for each type using a different API, instead of that, I have just this one single function I have to call, hub.send. And this goes ahead and enumerates the various channels for me and talks to the various push notification services for me and delivers one push notification to all the various devices I have in a single line of code. And, well, it's obviously simpler to write, but it's also scalable. So instead of a loop that goes over a million records and sends notifications one by one, Notification Hubs has an infrastructure for delivering millions of pushes. They used it, for example, during the Sochi Winter Olympics. They had a Windows Phone app and I think an iOS and Android app for the Winter Olympics, and they sent, I think it was tens of millions of push notifications daily through Windows Azure Notification Hubs. So it's really a scalable service that also happens to work. So again, the magic here is that when registering, the hub stores the registration, knows which device that registration is for, which kind of device, iOS, Android, Windows Phone, and so on. And when sending a notification, you don't care about how many devices you have, how many registrations you have, what sort of devices they are. The hub manages that. So again, this was just a very brief overview of notification hubs, and if you're interested specifically in that, there's another session coming up tomorrow. At this point, I would like to leave a little room for questions. You've been very quiet during this whole thing. So I'm just going to put up this slide with my blog and Twitter account. I'm going to post the code from today's talk, both the to-do item service and the rent-a-home application on all different platforms to my blog and Twitter account. And this is the time when you ask any questions if you have any. Yes, please. Is there a limit? Yes. So I haven't discussed pricing because I really wanted to focus on the technical aspects. But of course, there is a cost for the service. The free tier, which I was using for this talk, allows you, I think, up to 500 devices to which are registered and you can send pushes to. Up to a certain number of API calls, like get something from a table, insert something to a table. So the free tier has limits which are good for development. You're not going to hit that when developing. You're not going to have 500 development devices accessing the same service. Once you start scaling, they have two tiers of pricing. Let me just quickly go to the Windows Azure pricing calculator. If you haven't seen this thing, it's really useful. And so under mobile services, here are our tiers. So the basic tiers is priced in units. Each unit gives you 1.5 million API calls per month. 1.5 million API calls, again, that's an operation like read something from a table, insert something to a table, send a push notification. 1.5 million operations, depending on what your users do with the app, this could work for tens of thousands of users probably. And so one unit of those is 18 euros a month. There's also a standard tier, which has some additional features and scaling support. And here the units are 15 million APIs calls per unit, and that's 148 euros a month. I've never seen these prices in euros before. Back home, it shows me prices in dollars for some reason. So there is a pricing story here which you should check out, definitely. There's also separate pricing for notification hubs as well. So the free tier is 100,000 pushes per month to up to 500 devices. Again, the basic tier, 500,000 pushes per unit per month. Standard tier, 5 million pushes per unit per month. I'm sorry? Okay, so that's 50 million pushes. If you need to scale beyond that per month, you can talk to Microsoft directly. I mean, no, I'm serious. It's not unreasonable. I mean, at some point, you might scale beyond that. I mean, 50 million pushes, if you're building something like, I don't know, Instagram, you might have more than that easily. So yeah, there's obviously ways to scale beyond that, but it's not in the calculator. you have to talk to them. Yeah, performance-wise should not be a problem. I mean, again, it's an infrastructure that has, I'm just guessing here, thousands of servers sending these push notifications at once. So I think performance-wise for large-scale mobile apps, it should be fine, even something at the scale of Twitter or Facebook. Yeah?
What happens if your app exceeds that quota? What users see? Or is there some error that...
If the app, yeah, so... If the app exceeds the quota, you'll start getting errors from the service.
You can handle them.
Yeah, you can handle them in your app. Ideally, you'll monitor your usage. Yeah.
And another question, how do you can filter the users to push the notifications?
Right? Yeah, right. So how do you filter users to send notifications? So currently, when you have a channels table, you can store additional stuff in there. Like for each channel, you can store the username, or maybe their location, or maybe their interests, like sports or news or apartments in Amsterdam, right? So when you're storing the channels, it's up to you how exactly you associate this information with a registration. If you're using notification hubs, again, they have support for tags. You can associate each registration with an arbitrary number of string tags, which again can be sports, user ID, news, whatever. And when you push, you can specify a tag expression. Push to users who are both interested in sports and in news, or users in the Amsterdam region who are also interested in sports, and so on and so forth. Yes? Could you raise your voice just a bit? Right. So the question is if you can use something else instead of JSON. Well, the client libraries use JSON. I mean, they use JSON to send stuff to the service and get stuff back from the service. It is possible to expose custom APIs, which can use whatever you'd like, binary, XML, anything you can parse. But then you'd have on the client to send your requests manually. Right. Again, the client libraries, they have to also be aware of that. So the client libraries currently, they use JSON. It is possible, I mean, on all the client SDKs, there is this concept of service filters, which you can use to process the request before it gets sent and process the response before it's delivered to the application. So you could hypothetically write on all the platforms a filter which will do that, which will somehow translate the JSON request to XML. It's not out of the box, though. Yes?
Are you going to show the custom APIs?
Right. I haven't shown the custom APIs in this talk. The demo code does have an example of custom APIs.
And do you have a separate talk?
No, I have a talk on the .NET backend instead of a JavaScript backend, and I have a talk on notification hubs.
Okay.
We have 50 seconds to go. Any more questions? Yes?
Is it also possible to use
this
on private cloud?
To use it?
Private cloud,
right. So currently, no. I mean, there is this Azure pack which you can use with Windows Server on premises. It does not include mobile services at this point. It does include websites. And the mobile services is heavily built on top of Windows Azure websites, so it might happen at some point, but no, not right now. 20 seconds. Right, so this is just the time to say that we have some prizes if you fill the evaluation for this session and for all the other sessions in this conference. I hope you enjoy the rest of the conference. Thank you very much for coming.